Hello, California Report listeners. We know how important it is for you to stay informed about California news, and we hope you'll take just a moment to keep this podcast free and accessible for everyone by texting KQED to 90999 on your mobile phone to donate $5. Message and data rates may apply. Terms at mgive.org/T.
Funds for the California Report are provided by Chevron, an energy company encouraging innovation right here in California. This is the power of human energy. Information available at chevroncalifornia.com. The California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org. And URS Corporation, a global engineering and construction firm headquartered in San Francisco, providing engineering, construction, and technical services to public agencies and private companies. URSCorp.com.
This is the California Report. I'm Scott Schaefer. Coming up, questions about a 2-year sentence for a cop who killed an unarmed man.
This will have a detrimental impact on the relationship between the police and the African-American communities and the Hispanic communities, the brown communities, because of the tension that exists already.
Also, how the Capitol has changed since Jerry Brown left Sacramento 27 years ago. And Hollywood director Judd Apatow has made some of the funniest movies of the past 5 years. But what makes him laugh?
I do think that the terrible things that happen in life are really, really funny. And sadly, we never run out of those stories. They happen every day.
And how small-town California is reinventing itself. It's the California Report. And we begin today with a question of justice. A Bay Area transit cop who shot and killed an unarmed man at a BART station in Oakland nearly 2 years ago is going to prison, but not for long. L.A. County Judge Robert Perry sentenced Johannes Messerly to 2 years minus credit for time served. That's far less than the maximum 14 years he could have handed down. Prosecutors and the family of victim Oscar Grant wanted Messerly to get the harshest sentence possible, but defense attorney Michael Raines argued for probation, and afterwards he wasn't happy with the outcome.
Johannes Messerly is still in custody. He is still behind bars. And I can't be happy, and I can't rest, and I won't rest until he is out of custody.
Outside the courtroom, Oscar Grant's uncle Cephas Johnson spoke to reporters.
People want justice. There can be no peace without justice. I'm here with my family in Los Angeles, keeping them calm. I have no power over what people feel their form of expression should be.
LA Times reporter Jack Leonard was in the courtroom as the sentence was handed down, and he's with us now. And Jack, first of all, what was the judge's reasoning for this relatively light sentence?
The judge said that he believed, after looking at all the evidence, that that this shooting was an accident and that Officer Messerly never intended to draw his weapon, but had, in fact, meant to pull out his taser to incapacitate Mr. Grant. This was a much reduced sentence compared to what Mr. Messerly could have received. He could have actually got up to 14 years in prison. But the judge dismissed a gun enhancement, gun allegation, which could have been up to 10 years for Mr. Messerly. And the judge, in doing so, had a couple of reasons. One, he faulted himself for providing unclear jury instructions at one point. But he also then found that there was not enough evidence for this enhancement because it would have required the jury to have found this shooting to be intentional.
Now, Johannes Messerly did have a chance to speak today in the courtroom. What did he say?
Well, it was an incredibly emotional hearing. Messerly stood and read a script and was in tears for most of it. He apologized for the shooting, said that every day he thinks about this and prays for Oscar Grant, that he repeatedly said that it was an accidental shooting. He apologized to the public for the polarization that has occurred as a result of this. And he also apologized, as well as to Oscar Grant's family, to his fellow law enforcement officers, saying that he knows that his actions have led to more mistrust of police officers, particularly in the Bay Area, and strained relations, particularly with the African-American community.
Now, after the sentence was read, Oscar Grant's uncle came out and said angrily that Messerly never said he was sorry to the family. You were in court. Did you get a sense that he was apologizing, that he was saying, I'm very sorry that I killed your son or your nephew?
Well, he did say that he was sorry in court today. I think that many of the family members feel upset because he did not apologize much earlier. And he certainly didn't apologize directly to the family during the trial. And I think that was a source of a lot of anger. And you could see why they would be upset about that.
And Grant's family, of course, wanted the maximum sentence of 14 years. How did they react in the courtroom as the sentence was read?
Some were shaking their heads, and you could tell that that there was disbelief. And then they all walked out, even while the sentencing was continuing. So it was clearly people were very upset.
And then final question. This is not necessarily the end of the road here, correct? I mean, they could appeal. Oscar Grant's family attorneys could appeal. And I believe they're also talking about going to the Justice Department and the federal government.
Yeah, I don't know if the government will be able to do much, given that he has been convicted of a crime. That would be interesting to see if they start looking into it. But, you know, my understanding is that both sides can appeal. The district attorney's office can appeal the judge's decision to throw out the gun enhancement. And, yes, you're right, that Messerly's attorneys can appeal the sentence that he did receive, which is 2 years. One thing that's worth mentioning is that the judge actually made a mention of the fact that many people are going to be upset with his sentence, and he apologized for it. And he said that, again, almost apologetically, said that he had done the best that he could.
All right, L.A. Times reporter Jack Leonard. Jack, thanks so much.
Thanks very much.
Well, just days after getting elected governor, Jerry Brown is hitting the ground running. On Thursday, Brown held meetings in Sacramento with legislative leaders from both parties, pledging a bipartisan approach to solving the state's massive problems. It's been 27 years since Brown left the governor's office, but he's returning to a very different political landscape. The biggest change and his biggest challenge may be with the legislature. Sacramento Bureau Chief John Myers explains.
We may never know just why Jerry Brown wanted to be governor again. Since he left, the state has been twisted into knots and seems dug into a deep hole. Even so, the veteran politician sounds like he's under no illusions about the office he just won. Here's his take on the state budget the morning after the election.
There are those who want taxes, there are those who want only cuts, and then there's groups in the middle who will muddle around. And it'll be my job to try to sow some unity and clarity out of muddle and division.
But unity is likely to be the toughest of them all. And before he ever tries to unite the public, Jerry Brown's going to have to first try to change the culture that exists inside the California legislature.
It's going to be, I think, very frustrating for him to come in and try to enact a legislative agenda where that doesn't got to kind of go with the flow of where things would normally go.
That's Susan Kennedy, a woman who knows a thing or two about governors and legislatures. Kennedy has served as Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger's chief of staff the last 5 years. She was also a deputy chief of staff to former Governor Gray Davis. Kennedy made her comments at a post-election symposium Thursday in Sacramento, and she said unlike the legislature Jerry Brown worked with in the late 1970s, today's environment of term limits and hyper-partisan politics is not well-suited to big thinking.
You don't have the history, you don't have the relationships, you don't have the forward-looking. I mean, everyone's looking at the next 2 years or four-year increments. They're not looking at building the state or doing something that's going to come to fruition years after you leave office.
Perhaps just as vexing for the Democratic governor as Republican legislators will be his fellow Democrats. Not only are many more liberal than the seemingly pragmatic Brown, but they've had many of their legislative priorities stymied for 7 years by a Republican governor. Just ask Gary South, the chief political strategist to the last Democrat who tried to lead his party inside the state capitol, Gray Davis.
One of the biggest problems we had was legislation being shuttled over to the governor's office from the democratically controlled legislature that the governor was either damned if he signed it, damned if he vetoed it.
Jerry Brown's winning campaign for governor hinged in part on his promise to find a way to avoid such battles. Time and again, he has pledged to sit down with each and every legislator, 120 in all, and listen to their take on the crisis facing California. Brown has said that sooner or later, those negotiations have to produce a breakthrough. But that seems to assume legislators see the governor as the powerful force in Sacramento.
He's going to find a legislature that is much less interested in what a governor thinks and much more interested in what the special interests think.
Republican Jim Brulte led his party in both the Assembly and Senate before being termed out of office in 2004. He says unlike the veteran lawmakers Brown dealt with the last time around, today's Assembly members and senators will not heed the new governor's call for consensus if it clashes with the agendas of big money interest groups on the left and right.
There is no reward for bipartisan cooperation. In fact, there's a punishment for bipartisan cooperation. Just ask the two Republican leaders who were removed for supporting tax increases. So the first unpleasant surprise he's going to find is the legislature is geometrically more partisan.
Jerry Brown's first big steps will come in the next few weeks when he begins selecting those who will join him in the governor's office. And when he suggested this week he may forego having a chief of staff, some wondered if that displayed a naivete about the size of the task he's undertaking. Brown follows two governors who never quite found their footing with the state's legislature, but the governor-elect's early comments seem to imply that lawmakers and the body politic have failed to realize that the public is no longer willing to go along with the status quo.
We've been in a stalemate, and somehow we have to go back to the people and restore legitimacy to state government and earn people's respect to create some common purpose, and that's my goal.
That's a lofty goal, especially in a state where voters think the only thing that absolutely cannot be trusted is their elected officials who work under the Capitol dome. For the California Report, I'm John Myers in Sacramento.
Small towns in California have a very different set of challenges than Sacramento. Throughout the state, small towns that were built around industries like logging and mining have had to adapt as their economies collapsed. With that in mind, today we begin a series we call New Harvest, the future of small town California. First up is Lindsay, California. The Central Valley town once thrived with its olive and citrus groves, but 20 years ago, a statewide freeze began a series of events crippling Lindsay's economy. Then the town forged a new identity and is celebrating its centennial this year. Lisa Morehouse has our story.
The freeze that hit California in late 1990 left icicles on Lindsay's orange trees. A year later, a factory and an olive plant closed. Unemployment reached 57%, and breadlines were blocks long. The town decided to bury its troubled past.
In the midst of all the doom and gloom, civic leaders here tried something unusual, a mock funeral.
An NBC News crew covered the burial. Lindsay's residents still remember the event as if it were yesterday.
And we had a horse-drawn carriage with a casket.
Pall bearers, and it contained a can of olives. We put some frozen oranges in there.
One of the ministers actually said, I want you to write down all of your, excuse my language, bitches and gripes.
And we're burying all these problems.
Okay, now it's time to get over the mourning and do something.
They did. City leaders got creative, securing millions of dollars in state and federal grants to do things like build sidewalks, redevelop downtown, and rehabilitate crumbling houses. At community meetings, Lindsay residents decided that since they couldn't control the weather, they should diversify their economy. They applied to the state to be designated a business enterprise zone. With the tax incentives in that program, they lured a couple of plastics manufacturers and a convalescent home. They brought in a marmalade company, which can process even frozen citrus. And old businesses got new life.
This used to be a packing house that packed oranges and lemons.
Rocky Cortez stands in front of a building that once was a packing house, where he worked as a teenager in the 60s. Cortez works here today, but now it's called McDermott Fieldhouse. It's a 4-acre exercise and entertainment facility which employs 86 people, has nearly 5,000 members, and draws crowds and dollars with big concerts and other events.
On our bottom floor, we have a regulation soccer field. And on our third floor, we have a soccer field also. So soccer is a big sport.
Cortez shows off the indoor skate park, basketball courts, gym, laser tag arena, and rock climbing wall like he built them all with his own hands. There's even an indoor wave machine where kids who've never even seen the ocean can learn to surf. Cortez grew up in a family of fruit pickers. When more seasonal migrants from Mexico started to stay year-round, there was real hostility.
There was actually some streets that I was told not to walk down.
Cortez says that unwelcoming attitude has changed. Part of the downtown redesign is a new plaza that looks like small-town Mexico. It's home to Lindsay's Friday Night Market, where live music, food, and 250 vendors routinely draw thousands from Lindsay and the region. But there's some regret over Lindsay's change. Deanna Pettis was the town's librarian, and now her house and garage are filled with photos, letters, and articles documenting Lindsay's history.
The town was full of cowboys with their boots and their Western shirts, but that's kind of the flavor that the town had then. It doesn't have that same flavor now.
Pettis says Lindsay's population, at 85% Latino, is demographically imbalanced.
It's not a fault of anybody that we have become more Hispanic. I just think you learn more from different cultures. I'd like to see other ethnic groups here. I don't see much of the Japanese anymore, none of the Chinese people anymore. I miss having an Italian restaurant. We just don't have that kind of diversity anymore, and I think it makes for a healthier town.
But many power brokers in the town encourage immigrants to set down roots. They've gone after first-time homebuyer funds, and after another big freeze in 2007, Lindsay created a public works program to keep their out-of-work laborers, including undocumented immigrants, in town. That got the Republican mayor, Ed Murray, in hot water with conservatives across the country. So much so that a CNN reporter came to Lindsay to cover the story.
Like most of his fellow conservatives, Mayor Murray will tell you immigrants are welcome here.
They have made Lindsay's economy.
Some of the people who work on your public works project may be illegal.
It's possible. When a person comes across and has the proper documentation, is it our responsibility to go back and say, is this a legal card or not a legal card?
Is it not your responsibility?
No, it's not.
Like the mayor, city manager Scott Townsend is pragmatic about immigration.
If you sent every Hispanic male out of this country that was illegally in here, your food distribution system would come to a grinding halt.
He says a simple philosophy has helped in Lindsay's recovery, focusing on what's right, not who's right.
From religion to the immigration issue to like welfare issues and, you know, work issues. It's in a small town, it's hard to be a party line Republican every day or a party line Democrat every day because you have to move from those positions and you can't just stay over in this corner. I mean, if you do, you'll be isolated. It's like a family had different opinions inside the family, but they all were still living in the same household.
Townsend says he certainly doesn't have all the answers, but he thinks others can learn from the dialogue that happens in small towns like Lindsay. Take Townsend. He's a Mormon and has some conservative values, and he was a big supporter of Proposition 8, but he recently attended the wedding of a lesbian colleague.
We are very friendly with each other, respectful of each other, of those opinions, because we are neighbors and friends and colleagues. And in a small town, if you really want to be happy, you need to be that way. In a bigger setting, you can isolate yourself from each other, and you can be enemies.
So, my special person of the week is Esperanza.
At the weekly Kiwanis Service Club luncheon, the members, men and women, white and Latino, old and young, tell jokes, catch each other up on their lives, and raise money for kids' programs.
Heavenly Father, we want to thank you for allowing us to gather this day.
Lifelong Lindsay resident Rocky Cortez leads the group in prayer.
We're going to continue to bless our club. Continue to bless
the meeting continues with a hymn.
God bless America.
have to embrace change. You have to truly look at your community and see what does it have to offer. Right now, as you can see, we're moving forward with a lot of gusto, and we're only started. Gives me goose pimples.
Showing just how far it's come, Lindsay's been awarded the title of All-American City. It's a national honor given to towns which are examples of community problem solving. For the California Report, I'm Lisa Morehouse in Lindsay.
Deborah George was a contributing editor on this story. You can see a photo slideshow, read the reporter's notebook, and take a peek at upcoming stories in the series. You'll find all that and more at californiareport.org. Judd Apatow has made a huge career out of making people laugh. Apatow wrote or directed Hollywood comedies like The 40-Year-Old Virgin, Knocked Up, and Superbad. But what makes Apatow laugh? We get an idea in his new book, I Found This Funny, some of his favorite pieces of written humor. It includes dozens of passages from a diverse group of writers, ranging from Ernest Hemingway to David Sedaris. I want to begin by just asking you about the piece that you wrote for for this book. It's a diary of the time that you had some back problems, and it was a diary about Freaks and Geeks, the TV show that was eventually canceled. What did you learn from that experience, both that show getting canceled and Undeclared? There are two TV shows.
I don't know exactly what I learned. It was very, very painful. It felt like I had discovered this amazing chemistry with a group of people, actors and writers and directors, and we had something to say. We had stories to tell about our lives, and we knew it was working. And the idea that we were working for some giant corporation and the person who makes a decision made it very clear from the very beginning, I went to private school. I don't understand what you're doing. That was a terrible thing to discover. So we always felt like we were making the show with a gun to our head. This is going to end at any second, so we have to do all of our best ideas immediately. We were not open to any notes that the studio and the network gave us because it was so clear that we were going to get canceled anyway. Why would we water this down and still get canceled?
When that show and Undeclared were canceled, did you feel like, you know, maybe this isn't the right business for me? Or was it real? Did you really feel like they're screwing up? You know, the industry is just too conservative or not willing to take risks. I mean, what was your attitude about the industry?
I just thought maybe the thing I do doesn't work on television. I didn't feel like there was nothing for me to do in the entertainment industry. I just didn't understand how I was ever going to have a hit. I was walking with Ben Stiller one day, and he said, man, you really do a hit. Because I was the one guy of all my friends who never had the breakout. And so I was getting a little tired of my cult status, which is fantastic. But at some point, you just want a lot of people to see what you do. And suddenly, when I produced Anchorman and then directed 40-Year-Old Virgin, things connected in a larger way.
You grew up, I think, on Long Island.
Mm-hmm.
And you worked in the high school radio station.
Mm-hmm.
How did you use that to sort of further your interest in comedy?
I had a friend named Josh Rosenthal, who's still my friend. And at this high school radio station, he would occasionally go out and interview bands. So in 1983, he would go interview REM when they had their first record. Or Susie and the Banshees. I thought, wow, so you talk to REM? What? And I thought, could I do that with comics? Is there a way I could start a radio show and force Jerry Seinfeld to talk to me? And that's all it was an excuse to say to the people I looked up to, how do you do it? How do you write jokes? How do you get on stage? How do you write a movie? And so I interviewed about 50 people, everyone from John Candy and Guido Sarducci to Steve Allen and Howard Stern. And they told me, and I mean, that was in a way my college education. I would take this giant tape recorder and go to their apartments or comedy clubs and make them talk to me for an hour. And I had my list of questions. How do you write a joke? How would you describe what your jokes are like? What are the steps?
And so you would take these interviews and what, put them on your high school radio station?
A couple, but most of them I didn't even bother to air. I just wanted to talk to these guys. Yeah, and when I listen to them now, because I still have them all, I think, wow, that was some good information. There's some actually good information there.
So they were kind of mentoring you?
They were, and they were all on the precipice of success, most of them. So when I interviewed Jerry Seinfeld, it was before he had his TV show, and Leno, it was before The Tonight Show, and I interviewed, you know, Paul Reiser right after Diner. And so they had youthful enthusiasm. They didn't mind talking to a kid.
Do you have young comedians that you sort of mentor? I mean, I know you've with mm-hmm. some of the people in your movie, Seth Rogen, for example, you've been working with mm-hmm. him for a long time and continue to. What do you tell them? Not him so much because he's made it, but, you know, the ones who are the earlier generation.
My main advice I give young actors and comedians is to write. That if you want to succeed, you have to create your own projects. If you wait around hoping that you fit someone's already written role perfectly, you may never get the part. And I remember when I lived with Adam Sandler, when he first moved to California, we all knew he was going to be a giant star, but we didn't know how it would happen. And I watched him go on all these auditions, and he would never get the part. And he finally wrote his own movie, and he sat down, and he wrote Billy Madison, and then that's how his career started. And the same thing happened with Jim Carrey. He rewrote Ace Ventura. And so that's what I tell Seth Rogen. You have to write your own movies. Or Jason Segel. You will never make it unless you sit down and do it yourself. And, you know, Jason Segel sat down and wrote Forgetting Sarah Marshall, and Seth was in the middle of Superbad and later wrote Pineapple Express. And I think it's true for all those guys. That's why they're successful. They showed people what they do.
Your piece, like so many in the book, are based on real life situations. Mm-hmm. Do you find that real life is sort of the best raw material for humor?
I do. I there are people that can create stories from their imagination, but for the most part, as the years have gone by, I've become less interested in high concepts and more interested in the minutiae of what's going wrong in my mind, how my own life misfires. I do think that the terrible things that happen in life are really, really funny. And sadly, we never run out of those stories. They happen every day. I may be in the middle of one today.
Judd Apatow, his new book that he edited is called I Found This Funny, My Favorite Pieces of Humor, and Some That May Not Be Funny at All. Thanks a lot for coming
in. Thank you very much.
You can hear my entire conversation with Judd Apatow at californiareport.org. That's our show for today. The California Report is a production of KQED Public Radio. Our director is Susie Rocho. Paul Encore is behind the board today. We had additional engineering by Seal Muller and Howard Gelman. Victoria Maleon is our producer. Our senior online editor is Gabriel Cohen with help from David Marks. The senior producer is Ingrid Becker. The executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening. Have a good week. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the James Irvine Foundation, expanding opportunity for the people of California and supporting the California Report since its premiere in 1995. The California Endowment, building healthy communities because that's where health begins. More information at calendow.org. And the SunPower Corporation, offering high-efficiency solar energy solutions to households and businesses in California and worldwide. The SunPower Corporation, online at sunpowersolar.com.